You are listening to a session from the Sunstone 2013 Salt Lake City Symposium at the University of Utah. This particular session was recorded on August 1st, 2013, and is titled, Oh, Say What Is Truth, presented by Ki'imi Wenger, Greg Rockwell, Christine Haglund, and Matthew Knockleby. Sunstone depends on your generous support to fund projects like this podcast and other important endeavors in Mormon culture, scholarship, and restorationist pursuits. Please consider a donation.
Thank you all for coming to our panel today. I'd like to welcome you. I'm Ki'imi Wenger, and I'm going to be a moderator slash panelist, and we have a fantastic set of discussants today. So let's briefly introduce all of them, and then we will get started. So one of our discussants is Mr. Greg Rockwell. Greg is, in addition to being on the Sunstone Board, is a fantastic chef and is interested in the sociological implications of Mormonism. He is a partner at Accelerated Payment Technologies and is also a fantastic party host. And you should definitely take a look at the party event, which you are co-hosting. Yes. So, all right. Who else do we have? Christine Haglund is the editor of Dialogue, Journal of Mormon Thought, expert on Mormon feminism and German studies, and also on the meaning of truth, which is why she's here on this panel. And Matt Knockleby, and also Christine is also a fantastic cook as well. Matt Knockleby is also a fantastic cook, so I figured we've got a theme going.
I'm a rather mediocre cook.
Okay.
Yeah, that's okay.
See, this is the problem with truth. It's hard to pin down. So, Matt attended BYU, served a mission in Perth, Australia, blogs occasionally at Doves and Serpents, and recently received his PhD from Rice University. So, and I'm Ki'imi Wenger. I waste time on the internet on a frequent basis. I'm a Sunstone board member. I teach law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and I write on different civil rights topics and such. So thank you all for coming out to our panel today. We'll just briefly start with a couple of housekeeping announcements, the first of which is we are going to have some Q&A. Please speak into the microphone in the Q&A so that you can be heard for the people who listen to this, because there will be legions of them. Second, please take any devices that you have of the cell phone sort, put them in the silent position or off position so that they don't ring, ring, ring. Third, just to let you know, we are going to go with a slightly different structure on this panel. It's going to largely be in a round table format, so we're just going to talk about things for a short while, kind of keep tabs in your mind what you want to talk to us about, because then we'll have Q&A once we're done talking with each other amongst the panelists here. And there's one
other
thing.
Should we let them interrupt us as we go?
Yeah, and feel free. I don't know.
Well, that's hard with the microphone.
That's true. Never mind.
You know, if you feel the need to interrupt, kind of shout, and if we think it's a good interruption, we'll let you come up and talk into the microphone. So, and there was one other thing I don't know. And definitely check out, of course, our tables of very delightful books and other things, and especially feel free to pick up some of the Sunstone past issues, which we are crowdsourcing to you, our cleanup of past issues, by letting you take some of them. And there's actually a lot of them are really full of good stuff. So, everybody with me on all housekeeping issues? All right. So on that note, let's talk about truth. One second as I pull up the visual aids here. Work. Oh, come on, thing. All right. So we'll start with a statement which you may have heard before. Is this something anyone has ever heard before? I know this church is true. What does it mean? Greg, Christine, Matt, what do we think when we say, "What I know this church is true"? What's the content there? And how does this tell us about the place of truth in Mormon discourse?
I think the most telling thing that one can say about the statement is that somebody could say this simple phrase and assume that anybody whom they're talking to will be able to unpack that without any difficulty. The fact that words like church and true are accepted, like, without considering any of the baggage that actually comes along with that statement, is itself a statement about how Mormons tend to engage with truth.
I was going to say something similar, that it's essentially devoid of content, the way that we use it. It really says, I want to belong here.
Okay, I don't know that it's going to go along with that in sort of the typical chapel usage. So I think in the chapel usage of I know this church is true, there are some implied meanings that the speaker in general assumes, which are historical narrative based and which are truth claims based and that are authority based. So there's when someone typically, and I will admit that there are deviations from this among a more nuanced crowd, but when someone typically in fast and testimony meeting gets up and says, I know the church is true, they are saying a number of things about the way that they have been taught the story of Joseph Smith and the history of the church, and that they affirm that those events actually happened in the way that they have been taught. And they are saying that they believe that the Book of Mormon is a historical book which represents historical facts and which has a lineage of revelation from God, and that Joseph Smith translated that via power. They're saying that they believe that the restoration of the priesthood is a tangible fact. There's actually plenty of good general conference talks, or good as maybe, there are plenty of general conference talks that delineate what it is, kind of, that the testimony is, that Joseph Smith is a prophet, that the Book of Mormon is true, that the church has the authority now, and that God is running the show. And I think while I will happily say that there are people in here that mean something different when they say, I know the church is true. When my mom says, I know the church is true, that's what she means.
So I think that if it were as simple as that, Mormons would respond very differently when you confront them with something that problematizes those truth claims.
Why?
Because...
Why?
Because we're speaking in generalities here, so let's get that out of the way. The response is usually a response that comes out of loyalty. That is, there is a loyalty to the institution where the superficial... I like better words, like the superficial loyalty oath is an affirmation of these truth propositions. But they don't respond to problems with those truth propositions as though they are actually concerned about the propositions themselves.
Okay, but that is not a distinctively Mormon problem. That is a part of a human problem. And so brings us into, if you are ideologically motivated to either the left or the right politically, then your propositions about what is true in the world, whether climate change exists, are motivated by an ideology which has little to do with evidence. And that ideology will function as the filter by which you accept evidence and by which you function with it. And the church is the same way. So we could back up a step and talk about truth and the primacy of truth in terms of human discourse. And this is something that I am vastly interested in, because there's a explicit discourse about truth that we all participate in, and then there's a reality which is how people actually react to truth. And we're going to get in. The words are all messy in my mind, because like reality is an important part of that. So we think, as a culture and as humans, we think that something being true or so in my definition of the world, truth is an abstraction. It's a model that we create in order to try and explain reality. So truth is not a thing. Truth is a simplification of things that then helps us to understand and predict things. I think the truth, the function of truth is predictive. So truth is a conception. Is that an okay definition?
No, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
So it sounds like, I mean, we've got a couple of things going on right here. I mean, both, everybody has said this statement is a sort of tribal loyalty oath.
I
mean,
absolutely.
But at the same time, it's an unusual tribal loyalty oath, right? I mean, if I am loyal to the tribe of the Yankees, I say Yankees are great and Red Sox are terrible. Right. I mean, that's the sort of, what does it mean? When I look at the adjective there, like, pick another organization that you like, the Yankees or the Red Sox or the ACLU or the Republican Party or whatever. You know, I know the NAACP is true. What? Like, that doesn't even parse. You know, I know that the University of California is true. Like, what does it mean to attach the adjective true to an organization when...
It's a category.
What does that even mean? Oh, well, don't say that into the mic.
It's a category error.
So why is it that this category error has such a key place, a central place, in the affiliation of this is my tribe?
Well, does it start off with, okay, so I don't know if I want to
we got some people who want to
when I joined Mormonism, I said this, but what I meant by it is that this church differentiates itself from all the other Christian churches because it's the one that God approves. This is the true church in that sense. It's not talking about truth in a philosophical sense. It's distinguishing itself from all of the chaotic Christian sects that have existed since the death of Jesus. And this is the one that we should be in, for whatever reason.
So for the listening audience, I am going to repeat the mortal words of Paul Toscano, and who says, in essence, tell me if I get this right, it distills down to a validity challenge or validation of the truth as being God's organization vis-a-vis the apostasy.
Right.
It's the comparison.
Yeah.
This is the true church. All the other churches are less so.
But this is still a propositional claim. In this sense, what you're saying is there is this true proposition about the Mormon Church, which is that God has picked it or organized it or whatever, rather than a statement of loyalty or anything like that, as we're talking about. So I think there is still this distinction between propositions of this variety and then socially constructed ideas that we're talking about.
Polly.
So it is a category error, but you can make it not a category error if you say, I know the teachings of this church are true. And so perhaps you've just dropped out another noun. The story of this church is true. I know the teachings are true. And the reason it actually works as a statement of your belonging in a church is because it's a credo, which many Christian churches have. So it functions as the basic affirmation of faith that you have to do in many branches of Christianity. That's why it's your ticket into membership.
And this is explicitly problematic.
You have to distill what she said.
So what Holly has said is that essentially, I know the church is true can be made into a meaningful statement if what we really say is, I know that statements either about or by this church in terms of its teachings are true, and I agree with that. And this is explicitly difficult in Mormonism because pinning down what those teachings are is messy.
Okay, that's not the problem. Let's earmark that for a second and say that part
of the problem.
Part of
we have
the
objective truth from Greg.
Okay. One reason why I know the church is true persists as a phrase, even though it's a problematic phrase and kind of a stupid phrase, is that it has a rhythmic niceness with I'd like to bear my testimony. I know the church is true. I love my mom and dad. So those things go together, and that's part
how
of the
how can you possibly
it's...
say that there's an intrinsic rhythmic having heard that your whole life and being conditioned to it?
It's iambic.
It is iambic. Thank you. Okay.
All right, let's take a couple of more audience comments, and then we'll continue our conversation through that. So, yes, please go ahead.
If you question what people mean when they say this, how do you understand what God meant when he said this is the only true and living church?
Oh, good question. And certainly, yeah, it raises a great question, right? You know, if God uses adjectives in ways that I don't, wow, I guess I'm wrong.
So grammar is poor.
Yeah. I'm not going to correct the grammar of deity. Even deity sometimes messes up like your or something, who knows. It's a really good question, because where does this come from? It comes from Mormon scripture, which we will get to in just a moment, so just kind of put a tab on that because we're about to get to that. There was one other hand, I think. Was there not a hand?
Would Christine put this in dialogue?
Would Christine put...
Or would you edit it?
The truth is true. In dialogue.
I would put it in quotation marks if someone said it.
Okay.
That's okay. So we're saying that God needs an editor if this is what God is saying.
So can we go back to what Matt was saying for just a second, or move forward with slides? But the strength of the statement, going back to the truth is our conception of things that are predictive.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the statement is that when I say I know the church is true, it means I am willing to do behaviors that imply my trust in that statement, that explicitly demonstrate that I will do things that show, for lack of a better word, because it is a good word here, faith. And that's really where it makes a difference. I am willing to pay money. I am willing to spend time. I'm willing to consecrate myself, blah, blah, blah. So that's, I think, the key element here. And regardless of kind of what that means, it means that I will do this.
Yeah, and I think, and one other thing, and then we'll move on. The way it's tied to truth as a concept, right? Like, think of other loyalty oaths that we commonly take, right? The Pledge of Allegiance. We don't say the United States is true. We say I pledge allegiance to the flag. In the Scout oath, or a lot of us who are former Boy Scouts, and we don't say the Boy Scouts are true. So,
but this is a preamble for all of those things too. This is the beginning of a larger discourse.
Well, and yet, and one thing which I don't know if I agree with, but maybe we can try to tease out, does it mean that if I question the truth of certain claims, that is, if I question that word true, I'm being disloyal in a way that I wouldn't be if I, the Pledge of Allegiance doesn't tie me to true, the Scout Oath doesn't tie me to true, and I can say, certain things about the Boy Scouts are problematic. If my loyalty is based on an affirmation of the truth of the organization, does that constrain my ability to push back in certain ways?
I was just going to mention that I think that you talk about the church being true, the issue is one of authenticity, right? We talk about true believing Mormons, right? We have to do, what is a true Christian? What is a true Buddhist, right? We have certain qualifications, or a set of criteria that we look at a thing and say, yeah, this makes it authentic, right? When we talk about how we know the church is true, what we're saying is it meets some criteria that we have in our mind about what is authentic Christianity or what is authentic Mormonism. Does this organization represent that authentic tradition? We don't say that about the Boy Scouts because we don't have issues of truth and falsity in terms of authenticity of the organization, right? But we do in Mormonism because it's a religion. So, the issue is one for me of authenticity and what the criteria are of identifying what is authentic and what is not in terms of religious belief, practice, and organizations and so forth.
That's actually, okay, so distillation of that. The problem here is that we're looking at validating authenticity, and that when someone says, I know the church is true, the sender of that message has a list of criteria in their head that they are essentially saying are in fact real, and the receiver has a admittedly probably somewhat different list But in some way, it's a shortcut to understanding or to validating the authenticity of this religion. And it's important, what you're saying is it's different from the Boy Scouts or different from some other group because it is a religion. Consequently, it has truth claims about, has cosmological truth claims and truth claims about reality and truth claims about what God is like that are wrapped up in that, that are different than a secular organization. Is that a reasonable distillation?
Yes.
Next question.
Or slide.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, which brings us to this. You may have seen this before. You know, this is our sort of Mormon epistemological framework for discovering truth, right, or confirming truth. We've all heard this verse 1,000 times. I've taught this verse 1,000 times. I could probably still say it in Spanish. You know, it's like, you know, if you... And then look at the test, right? You ask God if these things are not true, and if you follow these requirements, sincerity, real intent, etc., God manifests the truth unto you, and by the power of the Holy Ghost, you know the truth of all things. It's a fascinating approach to uncovering what truth is. It's arguably, it's not uniquely LDS, but the level of primacy that we give this method of truth discovery is probably uniquely LDS. What does this tell us about how we discover truth and how that plays into the role that truth plays in the community?
So I want to say one or two things. One, this statement is a statement of methodological commitment. And so you're saying there is a... embedded in the statement is, of course, the idea that truth is the important thing, as we said before, that a Mormon is committed to his or her religion, at least essentially, because they believe the truth. But that there is a particular methodology by which you go about to test those truth claims that, of course, is circular in that you have to trust the text in order to accept the methodology.
Yep.
I just say that this is not the only methodology that we have prescribed in the Book of Mormon, right? There's also Alma 32, which is a much, much more open kind of system. Like, try it out. It right. sounds like something like evidence.
Right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, that there are other ways in Mormon, you know, there's the Doctrine and Covenants, like study it out in your mind. There's Alma 32, which is plant it like a seed. But that's sort of, you know, what does that mean, in a sense? And what does it mean, you know, when we want somebody to join the church? I mean, our missionary discourse is centered around these two verses, and they seem to imply a few things. Let's just tease out a few ideas. First off, that there is an objective truth, and the objective truth is that God likes Mormonism. Second is that your subjective experience is evidence of this objective truth. And then so there are some corollaries to this, which is if you pray and you don't feel like the Book of Mormon is the Word of God, there's something wrong with you, which is a very interesting sort of subset. But I think, I mean, that leads to a lot of personal pain for people, like, wow, what's wrong with me? I'm not getting the right result here.
Yeah, your use of the word interesting as an adjective there is a cop-out for what it really is.
Which is
atrocious.
Yes. So, you know, what's just to push on a little, what does this tell us? If I want to discover other truths, is this a valid to Matt's question or to Matt's comment? What on earth is this methodology? Is what's going on with this particular methodology that it not only ends up in the book, but ends up being the verses in the book that we as a community preaching to people who are outside the community choose to highlight as the single best methodology for uncovering truth?
I think you're taking this out of context.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that these things refers to the whole Book of Mormon history and what's ever there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in the climax of the Book of Mormon are these marvelous statements by Moroni about the love of God.
Mm-hmm.
The Book of Mormon ends on this almost Candelian kind of ending about the love of God. And what he's asking here is if these things about the love of God are not true. And it's interesting that he says are not true, because it's apparently written from the point of view of the person who's writing this, who believes they're true, and he's saying, well, you ask yourselves if what I believe is true is not true. But I think it's talking about, particularly at the end of the Book of Mormon, about these rather poetic and, I think, inspiring verses about the love of Christ and how that is the animating aspect of Christianity. And so maybe it can't be applied to asking whether, you know, which color naga hide you should buy for your couch, or whether this guy should be bishop or that guy stay president, but asking the core question about Christianity, whether God is a God of love or whether God is a tribal God of war. That may be what he's talking about.
So, and to distill that very briefly, I mean, Paul mentions, and it's, I think, definitely a potentially useful in a lot of ways, well, we'll get to that word in a minute, a very thoughtful reading to say this doesn't refer to sort of the particular Mormon narrative of, you know, Joseph Smith, the prophet, the Book of Mormon as an entity. This refers to specific verses about the love of God. At the same time, and I think that's in a lot of ways, a more beautiful reading than what is typically given, my experience and observation is these verses are generally used in a very instrumental way. This is, you know, the Book of Mormon promise, and in fact, there's President Benson saying, okay, it's a simple syllogism. They pray about the Book of Mormon, the Book of Mormon is true, therefore Joseph Smith, therefore baptism. And at least in current Mormon discourse, I think that's the dominant reading, and maybe why these verses get so emphasized by missionaries.
So, I mean, and Paul, and lots of people in this room, again, I think there's a very good possibility we could look at the way that you read the scriptures, that we read the scriptures, and think that there might be a different tenor taken in the general chapel approach. But that doesn't change the fact that it's being used that way, and that then if you said that, then are you saying, so God is answering your prayer when you feel good, but what he's really saying is the love of God exists, and then God is on the hook for being a bad communicator, which I'm willing to put him on that hook. So, the fact that it's used in this way to create a simple methodology is important, even if it's a poor reading. Is that not fair?
Well, I think it's fair. It is relentlessly Newtonian. Your position is relentlessly Newtonian, and that is to say, it's an either or proposition. I mean, I think that if you take the scripture, which is the word Christ is in there twice, and what it's talking about is your relationship to Christ in a soteriological sense. I don't think that I know how it's misused in Mormonism as the word church. I know the church is true. Well, the church in 1830 was not the corporate church. It was the saints, you know. Mm-hmm. What does that mean when you say the saints of God are true? Does that mean they're sanctified? I don't know what it means, how people use it. And I do know that these things can be taken out of context, but I don't think that they have to be interpreted in the worst possible way. I mean, when I study Shakespeare, I try to give Shakespeare the best interpretation that I can give out of respect, and not the worst interpretation. And I think the fact that you can give it the worst interpretation is not fair to the text.
This might be the moment to introduce a point that I'm thinking about, which is the difference between truth and complexity. So when he says Newtonian, all my physics professor kids' neurons start firing. I think I was probably 4 or 5 the first time that my dad drew a diagram of an atom for me and started telling me that the table we were sitting by wasn't really a solid piece of wood. It was actually all these, you know, little tiny particles and mostly empty space. And, you know, for a 5-year-old, that is very disconcerting. And, you know, I walked around for a couple of days going, and I lived in Los Alamos, New Mexico, so this was happening to children all over town and all over my ward. So, you know,
we had a primary 3-minute talk about how truth is our intelligence is light and truth, and what that means if light is a particle, and what it might mean differently if light's a wave for 10-year-olds. So these ways of speaking about the world are kind of baked into the way that I think about Mormonism. But that's not true, thankfully, for most people. But there is this complex narrative, and kind of by definition, the fact that we're in this room probably means that we're the sort of people who prefer complexity in our narratives. And that's not necessarily a virtue. That doesn't necessarily get us any closer to truth. I mean, it's true both that this is mostly empty space and that it's a table. And it's really a lot more useful. The same thing is true and useful in the same sentence invokes very scary things for lots of people. But it's really more useful to know that it's a table than to know that it's a collection of atoms. Conversely, and this is a really stupid and embarrassing example, but it works. So I have recently had occasion to become acquainted with the pop psych literature on how to survive a breakup. And one of the most popular titles in that genre is He's Just Not That Into You. And the thesis of this book is that people, particularly women, tend to invent narratives to explain men's behavior that are, you know, well, it's the wrong time, or he's still hurt from his last relationship, or, you know, we have these complicating stories that we want to tell. And it's really more useful to just boil it down to the binary, he's into you or he's not into you, and cut your losses and move on. So I think we're always navigating this just the fact that we cannot handle the truth, right? That movie speech is right. You can't handle the truth.
You're anticipating the other slide.
Sorry. But we can't. And so we're constantly creating narratives. And the fact that some of us prefer complex ones or more complex ones than others is largely an accident of temperament. And we get in trouble when we start thinking of it as a virtue or as evidence of superior intelligence, because it may or may not be either of those things.
You know, I think we're going to, if it's okay, I think we're going to segue to the next slide, because I want to get into this one a little bit, which was presaged by some of these comments, which is the flip side of our adoration of truth. Truth is wonderful. Truth is great. We love truth. Some things that are true are not very useful. What does that tell us about how truth gets used in the community or doesn't get used in the community? What message do we take away from this? Can you be too truthy? Can one be too truthy? Everybody's looking at me like I'm insane. Okay, well, I'll just take this one for myself for the moment and say, you know, I think it shows a... So early on, Matt talked about how this is a loyalty oath about truth, that in a sense, this is what happens when truth and loyalty run into each other, right? Which is loyalty trumps, or at least we are told loyalty is supposed to trump truth. That truth, in part, an affirmation about truth, is our loyalty oath, but when it comes down to it, if there is a true, objectively establishable fact that Joseph Smith married 30 women and that some of them were already married and that one of them was 14 and etc., that we are not supposed to talk about that because some things that are true are not very useful. And at the same time, I think there's truth in this, but I don't know if it's all that useful as employed in the LDS context, right? I mean, some things are true and not useful. You learn, you know, the deep, dark secret of one of your friends, you know, somebody did something terrible and they're working through it with their therapist or whatever, and you shouldn't announce that from the mountaintops. And yet, the way that this probably true phrase gets used in the LDS community seems kind of unuseful.
So I actually want to turn this statement on its head into something that, from something that I don't believe to something that I do believe, which is, so I'm going to make a few philosophical statements since we're trying to have a philosophical discussion about truth, which is that I'm a very committed pragmatist. The idea of there being an objective truth out there that I can get my hands on maybe, well, no, but it is almost certainly false. The idea that there's an objective truth out there, I have no idea. Whether or not I can get my hands on it is much easier to ascertain. It's almost certainly not true. And so instead of having worrying about what's true, what we really have is a bunch of different methodological frameworks that work. Some work well in different circumstances, some work better in others, and they interlock together maybe well in some cases, maybe not well in others. And so instead of saying there are truths that are not useful, I'm saying for all practical purposes, there isn't truth. There are only useful or non-useful methodologies. And so when we want to look at whether or not what we do with historical things, whatever, if our goal is to maintain our loyalty to the institution, then we'll want to deploy one framework. If we want to, get at something that's more accepted in the historical community, of course you're going to deploy another methodology. But these aren't necessarily methodologies that have anything to do with truth in an objective sense, but just in a goal-oriented achieving our aim sense.
And that's certainly the intent that you can derive from Packer. And so going along with what Holly said earlier about the phrase is incorrect because it's missing some words. Yeah, some things that are true are not very useful if you want to stay in the church is what that ends up, or if you don't want to stay in the church, or if you want to be if anywhere you want to end up. I wholeheartedly agree with that.
It's a sort of about confirmation bias, right?
Right.
It's just saying that these true things don't exist in a vacuum, and we're always deciding which truth to use.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We do decide which truths to use. So two things on that. First off, one of the most fascinating psych studies, since we're talking about psych, the one where they showed a set of people who were Republicans and a set of people who were Democrats the same set of stories, and this was a few years ago, and the question was something like, does this show that President Bush is doing a good job or a bad job? And this was the exact same set of stories, and the Republicans said, this shows that he's doing a great job, the Democrats said, this shows he's doing a really bad job, and people took the same pieces of evidence and just dropped them into their narratives in different places. So,
okay, there's a lot of will in the way that we're talking about this, though. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to be careful of that. So it's, like you say, it's not really about what you want, it's about preference, but where does preference come from, and can you derive the source of preference? Is there a reason why I like blue and why my daughter likes yellow? And I don't know that we can get to an answer of that. So you have a problem of free will in the end of saying, do I want to... Oh, Mark, Matt's making a face.
I'm cutting out before you get to
it.
I think the question of free will doesn't engage here. I mean,
dang it!
Once we have preferences, it doesn't really matter where they came from. We're going to deploy our frameworks in order to... achieve our preferences as best we can. Worrying about where they came from, I think, is at a meta level to where we're discussing.
Okay, no, that's fair. But the reason why it matters is because we make judgments upon other people based on their preferences, based on their actions that derive from their preferences, and we make judgments about what they are doing and what their intentions are there, when their intentions are maybe inscrutable, or almost certainly inscrutable even to them. And so you say, if your objective is... that's all. No, it's just that we make judgments on the intentions of others based on their preferences, and that's not
right.
Fair. That's not fair to conservatives and Republicans in the example that Kanye was using about our dear departed president.
Yeah, so I think that's ultimately a question of differing methodologies, and so the problem with... Christine made a comment earlier where she said that an appreciation for complexity isn't necessarily better or worse. I want to make at least a mild argument for it being a good thing, which is that when you appreciate the fact that you are working in a methodology that's contingent, like you just happen to have the particular preferences for the methodologies that you're using, then you realize my methodology is different from somebody else. So when I judge somebody else according to what I perceive their preferences to be, I am capable of seeing they have a different methodology than I have. If I believe that there's some objective methodology that everybody has or that I'm in possession of, I am powerless to do that.
Okay, and launching off of that as well, the complexity issue is not so much that there are some people who like complexity and some people who don't. The issue is, you will like complexity when you don't care so much about doing something, and you will dislike complexity when you feel like you need to make a decision. So when action is required, your appreciation for the complexity of the situation will diminish.
So it sounds like Matt is essentially making an argument for methodological pluralism, that pluralism, methodological pluralism, and the recognition that other methodological approaches exist is superior to a non-pluralist approach where I only recognize that my own methodology may exist.
That's correct.
But it's superior for what? I mean, if the aim of the community right. is to behave like Christians, mm-hmm. then you don't really need a very complicated mm-hmm. understanding of the resurrection or of, you know, various atonement theories or whatever. The woman in my ward who just thinks that it's her duty and her job to, you know, bring casseroles to everyone who could possibly need some and then 10 other people is doing a much better job of being a true Christian than I am as I sit and, you know, parse Anselm's theory of atonement compared to, you know, I mean...
I think that's great as long as you're in a methodologically homogeneous community. As soon as you have to work across methodologies... it's unless you want to always be a conflict with them, it's useful to be able to realize there is a different methodology out there that may or may not be as legitimate as
sure, but in that case I think that the people with the preference for complexity are the ones who need to know that the most and take account of it that, mm-hmm. you know.
So we had a couple of hands, so let's take a couple of questions and then I think we're going to segue into a quote which has been making the rounds, at least on Facebook and Pinterest, an Ukberg quote about truth. And anyways, we'll talk about that in a moment. But there were, I thought I saw a Christian. Did you have a question?
That was a long time ago.
All right. All right. Well, so let's then talk a minute about Ukberg and this beautiful dandelion. Oh, there is a hand. Where's the hand? Who was raising a hand? Oh, go ahead.
Just a comment. I think truth may be, well, I won't say maybe. I think it's overrated as a conception. I mean, an example of, you know, the search for truth, if you take a family and they look at the same event and they may describe two different things, but they are true to them, and who's to say which is true or false, that there is a lot of relativity, and people get froze up at the even in truth, and that I think culturally we may overrate the need or the conception of truth. It can be dangerous. If it's truth, then this has to be wrong, and it's part of our extreme thinking. I just comment.
Go ahead.
All right. You so go first. I'm just going to distill. He said basically that truth may be overrated, that it may not be as useful to us as we think it is. It may not be as necessary. And I was just going to chime in that there are all kinds of studies that show that people who are mildly depressive have a more accurate perception of how the world really is, and that people who are psychologically healthy tend to overestimate the resources they have, underestimate the amount of time that, you know, I mean, they are deluded, yeah. It just whispered in my ear, and that is very functional.
I was going to say that, yes, truth is overrated, but truth is overrated because truth is unmanageable and unapproachable and unavailable.
It's also not pragmatically what we think is important, but it's not what we act as if it's important. So we believe in our cognitive brains, we believe that the truth is the most important thing. I had the closest I may ever get to an actual revelation walking to get a donut in Portland in the middle of a lot of turmoil about this very concept when I had the thought come to me, the primary motivation of humans is social. Because I had always thought that the primary motivation of humans was truth. That was what was supposed to be, what was real, what existed, was supposed to be what we were supposed to act by. But then I realized, no, what people are actually acting by, what that statement of loyalty, I know the church is true, is about sticking with your tribe. It's about sticking with what your DNA says will help you survive, because your DNA doesn't care about physics. It doesn't, your DNA cares about other people. We care about other people. We are primarily social beings. We are among the most social animals on the planet, right?
So what you're saying is the truth is, to use a term from science fiction analysis, truth is a MacGuffin. This is a term, you know, so when you have your sci-fi story about the people on the rocket ship or whatever, the MacGuffin is something which they think they're interested in and which the storyline is sort of driven by in a sense, but actually there are other things going on which are much more important. And so they think they're actually, you know, they think they're going to this planet to, you know, bring supplies to, you know, colonists or whatever, and in fact they are doing something else and they don't know it. So MacGuffin is commonly used in sci-fi as a plot-driving device. Is truth a sort of MacGuffin that we like to think that we're focusing on, but in fact we're not?
So my quick response to that, in as much as any of my responses are quick, I apologize, is that truth really confines itself to, say, physical interactions. It's very important that if I walk off the edge of a building, I will splatter, and that's a bad thing in my mind. But I don't like that idea. And so so my interactions with the physical world are governed by the kind of objective truth that we're always searching for. But my interactions with people, which are arguably the more important interactions I have with the world, I have interactions with the physical world, and I have interactions with other people, those are not governed by that kind of objective physical truth at all. And we give ourselves fits because we think that truth should transcend both of those relationships, my relationship with the physical world as well as my relationship with other people, when in fact it's a totally different value system to be dealing with other people.
So is it, let me just push on that a second, is it what you're saying, that our preoccupation with truth is a sort of pre-modern lizard brain sort of focus, like, you know, but when you are a hunter-gatherer, it's really important that you know what the truth is.
Yes, that is precisely where I'm at.
And since nowadays we have, you know, enough food, at least in the United States, you know, you feed yourself, you clothe yourself, you don't get eaten by lions, and suddenly this lizard brain focus on truth is a lot less important?
Yes.
I actually want to argue exactly the opposite. I want to say that it's a post-enlightenment learned behavior rather than something intrinsic.
Wait a second, didn't you tell me a few weeks ago that taking a post-enlightenment approach and talking, maybe I'm...
Probably not.
Oh.
I mean, this could be overstated, I'm sure, and there's probably important ways in which I'm wrong about this, but it seems that we care a lot about truth because in a post-enlightenment, post-scientific revolution age, we are taught that these are the things that will save us. These are the things that will give us all the progress that we've gotten, et cetera, et cetera. So we are taught that truth is its own virtue.
Ooh. Is truth a virtue?
Go ahead. No, you please.
All right. I'm going to do the concrete, practical thing. I have a son with an autism spectrum disorder, and I'm probably, you know, one of, well, my kind of parents of this kind of children might be the only ones who are ever thrilled that their children lie. My son was about 10 before he ever told even a small fib. And, you know, one day I asked who had eaten the cookies, and all three of my children said they hadn't done it. And I was so happy, because in order to lie to me, my son had to care about what I thought. And that's a hard thing for him. And so I spent a lot of time trying to teach him that, yes, you're right that it would be more efficient to play the game this way, but, you know, if the other kids want to do it this way, and you will be happier if you do it that way, even though that is not the right way. And so this, you know, the way that we decide what is true and what is right, you know, it's the dual magisteria you're talking about, the social and the physical. They don't always overlap.
So part of necessary socialization is an ability to lie?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
So, yes, I would love to be on that panel. On the flip side, I think, you know, we can... So this what does it say? So I mean, the quote itself is interesting, but I think even more than that is the fact that this showed up on 1,000 Facebook walls, like, 2 weeks ago. So this is something which resonates with people in the LDS community, and it's a Dieter Uchtdorf quote that truth exists beyond belief. It's true even if nobody believes it. What is that saying, and why does it resonate with Mormons?
Well, it doesn't just resonate with Mormons. So it would resonate with anyone who feels like their vision of reality is being embattled. So going back to the tired but relevant example of global warming or climate change, this could be put up above any post about that. You know, any write-up from Slater, from anywhere else about climate change could be presaged by this statement. The thing about Mormons is that they have a bit of a persecution complex about the truth claims of the church, and so, you know, they're confronted with that frequently.
Would it be resonating as much if it had been said by the presiding bishop?
Yeah.
Rather than the silver fox?
I think the fact that Dieter Uchtdorf's name on it has a lot to do with why it's resonating, because he's the first chair in the symphony. And it's not going to resonate if it's going to be somebody else. But it is interesting that he's thinking about this idea and that he puts truth beyond belief, which is resonates, it not only resonates, I think it's a very, it's an odd statement coming from that source, because it questions, it's subversive of both the statement of the word truth, and it's subversive of belief, and it's subversive of the idea of the fact that groupthink doesn't make it true. It's all stated there, and the fact that it's resonating is kind of, it should give the leaders of the church pause to think why this is resonating.
So to sum that up, Paul is just saying that this is, in a lot of ways, a subversive statement, particularly coming from whom it's coming from, because it is saying that truth is what it is beyond belief, and so therefore, regardless of what people believe, maybe including a large collection of religious believers, there may be some other truth out there. So one thing that I want to point out here is that this statement was posted a lot among LDS people. It was also rather enthusiastically accepted by ex-Mormons and apostates who think that statement is just as true, but that what the truth is that exists beyond belief is very different than what Elder Uchtdorf seems to have had in mind. And yeah, that's all I'm going to say about that.
Well, no, and it lines up with people. I've had friends who told me that Gordon Hinckley was giving kind of a wink-wink when he said, it all depends on whether this happened or not. If it happened, then it's all true. And if it didn't happen, then it's all false. And I have various apostate friends who think, and that was kind of a wink-wink, I'm giving you the hint here. But church leaders have been doing that and approaching rhetoric this way for a long time. It happens to be, and I totally agree with Paul, that Dieter Uchtdorf occupies a special haloed spot where everyone likes him, where I like him, and everyone else likes him, and I don't like all of the 12 in the same way, but I like him. So he gets a pass for using that kind of rhetoric, I think, automatically.
Yeah, just the same point that, like, I am open to when I read that statement, thinking of it positively because it's coming from him. And to me, it kind of strikes me as the flip statement of an Emerson quote that I used to just loathe about, you know, to think that something is a personal good for yourself is great, but to think that it's true for all mankind, that is genius. I just used to think, like, oh, Emerson, you fascist, you know? But I really, so much of it is what I think that person's intentions are. And I would assume all kinds of ill intent if it came from a different 12. And I'm open to the idea that the intention behind it is to open the conversation and to broaden it and to find a less strict, a less narrow, and a less punitive definition of what is truth.
Awesome. So to distill, Sarah said she has a crush on Dieter Uchtdorf.
Everybody's going to say I do.
So that's okay. The rest of us do too. And no,
it's already been tweeted, Sarah.
Sarah mentioned that it does go to the question of intent. And, you know, when I look at Emerson, and it's, you know, if you're saying things about yourself, fine. If you're saying things about everybody else, that could be genius. Ooh, is that a bad idea? Are you imposing a view on other people? Or is this opening a conversation in a sort of beautiful way? And maybe we're more willing to see Buderichdorf as less imposing his views on us. And we have two hands. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if Boyd K. Packard said this,
yes,
even if the dandelion, I would have read it completely different, and it probably would have pissed me off, honestly. Just because of, I think, the way he comes at things, as opposed to the way, you know, a beautiful leader, doesn't matter. He's got an accent, he's pretty, it doesn't matter. And so he'll be like, okay, I'll take it. Or, you know, Boyd K's kind of, I feel like a lot of us feel like he's kind of coming at you. I think I would have read that and felt offensive.
That makes sense. And to distill, Laurie also has a crush on Dieter. Beautiful Dieter. But as you mentioned, and absolutely accurate, if we saw this with the name Boyd K. Packer underneath, it would raise everybody's hackles and we'd say, ooh. And we don't do that with Dieter on here.
I did.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's because you're a misanthrope.
Maybe.
The man from Detroit?
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness, yes. Go ahead.
So I'd like to confirm that I have a crush on him, too.
Yes.
But the question...
Grant has a crush on Dieter as well.
But you asked the question of why would this be making a round on Pinterest and Facebook? And part of me almost wonders if it's because that third clause there, it is true even if no one believes it. I think Mormons like to cling on to that because, in a sense, it's almost like saying, we got this secret out there. And you might not believe it, but it's a truth, even though you might not believe it. And I think even that is really indicative of kind of where we are. At least those people that are out there online that might be passing this along, their view of things versus people like us who might be talking about it from a lot more of a philosophical context rather than a, see, this is true and this is reaffirming to me that what I have is true.
Yeah, I agree. I think that how to put this? I'm going to say this too strongly, which is great. People are using this because they want to appeal to the objectivity of their own beliefs, and appeals to objectivity are always rhetorical bludgeons.
Right, and Brent mentions the
Christian's hands been
instrumental use of this. I was just very quick distilling, and yes, and Christian, go ahead.
I would like to say, I like this even though I don't feel I'm one of the people who knows what this truth is. And I really hope there is this truth that all these other people are talking about and have been telling me about my whole life, and someday I get it. And so having it confirmed again that there really is some truth out there, even if I don't know it yet, is comforting to me, even though I'm not one of the ones who says, I know the secret.
That's fantastic. This is a comforting statement, as Christian mentions. It reaffirms there's something out there, and part of the purpose of religion is to comfort. It's fascinating, and I think Brent highlights the last clause, right? Because one of our tools in confirming or not confirming truth is whether or not other people are reflecting this back to us, right? So everybody picks up wrong ideas here and there. And, you know, I think my oldest son, who was, he was using a word the other, he used the word arbitrary, and I forget how he used it, but it was completely wrong. And I was like, that's not actually sort of how that word works. And, oh, okay, it's like he had seen it somewhere, he thought he knew what it was, and it was corrected. And we all go through that process of sort of like thinking we know something and then having others reflect back to us, no, that's not accurate, and then changing our own view to reflect that. And I think what this says is even if other people reflect back at me, Mormonism, these particular claims, historical claims about the Book of Mormon or whatever, are not accurate, I will refuse to accept that feedback. Sorry. No, go ahead.
And just to piggyback, that's why I think methodological pluralism is useful, is a good thing in the world, because if we self-select only people who have these Moroni 10-4 experiences, whether or not there's a predisposition that some people have them, some people don't, I think they do, but whether or not there are some people that have had them and some people who haven't, and if we only accept people into our faith, into our community that have these experiences, then we miss out on a very large segment of the population that doesn't have these experiences or hasn't had them yet or maybe never will, and we want them too. I want a community that has those other people.
That's fantastic. And Christian also mentions, I mean, this is a reason to accept a methodological pluralism so that people who don't go through this particular truth narrative internally and confirm it a certain way are still welcome in the community. So one thing which we definitely want to get to, because this was also a really fun part of the conversation we were having online about this, is the way in which a very different type of truth prioritization happens in the ex-Mormon community. And in a way, this is perhaps an even larger fetishization of the idea of truth, and perhaps a bit misdirected. I don't know. What do we want to... Let's turn the time over to our panelists.
Worshipping at the altar of rationality. Yeah, and it's such a massive mistake. Partly because humans are not rational, and because it's just a reflection of bad dogma, probably slightly better dogma in terms of its sort of evidenceability, but still a dependence on a set of beliefs and sort of this reflexive us versus them stance that is not. Too much more useful.
So, how do I want to put this? I think that what happens when a lot of people leave the church is that they have taken for granted a lot of the Mormon framework, the mainstream Mormon framework, and then the Mormon framework defines itself in part in opposition to what the rest of the world, or at least the rest of the secular world, believes. But it also takes on a lot of the same baggage, in particular the glorification of the objective reality. And so when somebody leaves Mormonism, it's easy to discard the elements the elements that are oppositional, the elements where Mormonism defines itself in opposition to the rest of the world, but it's very, very difficult to realize that you even have the baggage that was consonant with the rest of the world. Do you even know that there's any baggage to consider, let alone discard? And so when you get people who are worshipping at the altar of rationality, it's because, you know, inside the church, we thought that we were rational and in possession of objective truth. We get to the outside, people claim to value the exact same thing, so I don't know how not to value that thing. Now, I think the problem with rationality isn't that rationality is a bad idea, but that, again, you don't have access to it. If there were some perfectly rational something, then you could factor in all of the factors that, you know, that you should lie in social situation, all these sort of things. But the problem is that you don't have rationality, and so worshipping at the altar of something non-existent is problematic.
Sarah.
Well, I just got to give a sermon at the Unitarian Church with Joanna Brooks, and I was very pleased to be able to tell my congregation that we're guilty of doing something called secular splaining, where we think that we already... we think that, you know, we are in possession of all these facts about Mormons, and so we don't really need to approach interfaith dialogue the same way we would with anybody else, but you can... And I couldn't convince someone just using a rational argument, like, no, you're doing it, you're doing that thing. But by using a sort of, thought experiment of saying, how would you approach someone, who's Muslim, then my congregation could easily see we would never approach it that way. We would never assume this set of information. And just being able to divest yourself of that surety and that confidence that I don't need to be open to another objective reality because I already got it. Like, I've already covered objective reality. Like, that's what I'm really good at. Then you can't even begin that conversation. And I don't think that it's one that, you know, has some kind of easy conclusion, but I think just divesting yourself, and just a quick plug for Cynthia Bailey Lee and her teaching model, that was what was most useful to me, was hearing the sort of empirical evidence that we are hardwired for confirmation bias. We are hardwired to edit our own narrative and to give ourselves better intentions than we have to say that what is important to us and what is true to us and what is valuable, things that we pay the least attention to, and doesn't actually reflect that. But the good news is that when it is raised to our consciousness, when we say, here's what you say is important to you, and here's what your actions are, and here's the distance in between them, and I can, you know, empirically show it to you,
we're amazing as humans at shifting that, of saying, oh, okay, yeah, I see that now, and now I can begin to correct it. But first we have to raise it to our consciousness. So my question for you guys is, what you think is the most valuable kind of non-confrontational, or it could be confrontational, but actually yields results? Like, not like it's the right thing to say, but that you've seen work.
So, Matt and I were actually talking about this a little bit last night, in terms of what is, how conversations are happening and the way the world is today, and what Matt says, I have no idea what's true. We frequently draw parallels, at least in the apostate community, we frequently draw parallels to the gay community in terms of Mormonism and coming out. And the gay community has learned that the best thing to do to gain acceptance is for people to realize that they know someone who's gay and that they like that person. The nice thing about, one of the many nice things about Facebook, among things that you may think are terrible about it, is that many people have become aware that they are friends with and appreciate people who have a different idea about the truth claims of Mormonism or many other things in a way that they did not before. And that is changing the discourse. It's changing the discourse at my work. It's changing the way people react to each other because we are aware of things that we were not aware of before, that we didn't have access to knowledge about that. We have access to knowledge about what kinds of articles people post, and you kind of know that there's a pluralism among beliefs about that. I think that's really helpful. I think anytime you attach human emotion and story to that, that's what is going to move people.
Well, Christine, you.
Last week, or 2 weeks ago, when the New York Times article about Mormons was on the front page, was it last week? We had a brand new Sunday school teacher in our ward, and he got up and started talking about this New York Times article. Then he talked about Lucinda Morgan standing at the foot of Joseph Smith's coffin weeping because she was one of his wives, and she was one of his polyandrous wives. And so what he did was to say, look, this knowledge that scares people and, you know, puts them on the front page of the New York Times saying that Mormonism is bad and lies, we can handle this knowledge, or we can interpret this knowledge even in our faith community in a different way, without explaining it away, without lying about it. You know, we can take hold of this object, you know, this one measurable truth that we have, that we are, you know, have historical verification for, and we can discuss it in a context that is essentially faithful. The other example I was going to give of just sort of changing the discourse from within. Last year I was teaching 8 and 9 year olds the Book of Mormon in primary, and we got to the Alma 32 chapter, and I made them all junior naturalist badges and gave them magnifying glasses and notebooks and sent them out to observe the plants around our chapel. And they all came back with notes, and they said things like, they're all different, different kinds of plants grow next to each other. Even the ones with the same flowers are different heights. None of them are perfect. You know, some of them are broken. And they immediately, you know, I thought I was going to have to sort of spoon feed them the analogy when we got to Alma, and they, you know, they were right there. And so I do think that there are resources within Mormon discourse to, you know, to move towards this methodological pluralism, if that's, you know, where we choose to do it.
And I think that this is something that the Mormon apostate community does a bad job of acknowledging, that it is possible within a faithful framework to take all the facts that, you know, got me or Greg or whatever out of the church and realize that one can contextualize them, maybe even without working that hard, if, you know, that context has a long enough history, etc. The assumption frequently is, well, there exists a certain deployment of Mormonism, and that's the only deployment that's legitimate, and facts that conflict with that deployment falsify that deployment, and now there are no deployments left. And so, in general, it's often difficult for apostates to appreciate somebody who might try to make other frameworks work.
I've noticed.
Which I guess gets us to the words up on the slide.
Right, yeah. What is a TBM?
It's a very, very loaded statement. So, do we need to answer? Okay, sure. So in both liberal and apostate, and I guess even faithful, I don't participate in many of the very faithful online communities, the acronym TBM means True Believing Mormon, or sometimes True Blue Mormon. It's used as a shorthand, often pejoratively, for somebody who accepts the mainstream instantiation of the true claims of Mormonism. And as a phrase, it's fine. You need a bookmarker for somebody, you know, for whom you have a lot of examples and you know what you mean when you talk about it most of the time. But what often happens is TBM becomes enlarged to sort of anybody who is kind of still in the church, or said anybody who still believes in any sort of even reasonably mainstream way. And so these people are sort of painted with a brush that forces people on the more disbelieving end of the spectrum to be confused about how those people could be in the state that they are, knowing the information that they know.
And that's back to the complexity problem, right? I mean, it's an oversimplified narrative that then starts to not work so well.
And actually, to what your cousin, right, Seth? Is Seth your cousin? Seth Payne?
No.
Okay, but. Oh, yeah.
John
Payne. Well, anyway, yeah, Seth
Payne, probably is.
Seth probably is somewhere, yeah.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, life is pain. And so Seth Payne has a fantastic paper about this where he talks about the deconversion narrative and how it mirrors the conversion narrative, and how somebody's like, you know, the conversion narrative, I used to be a lost sheep, and then I found, you know, Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon, and now I know the truth. And then there's this deconversion narrative, like, I used to be a mindless sheep, and, you know, and then I found Grant Palmer, and, you know, and now I know the truth. And it's this very self-congratulatory, like, wow, look at me, I've got the truth, and those people don't.
That paper's going to be in Dialogue in the next issue, so you should subscribe if you don't.
Does it contain the phrase, the church is true?
I don't remember.
Paul.
I think one of the reasons why TBM has emerged is because fundamentalist is occupied by polygamy.
Also, is one of the reasons TBM has emerged is because fundamentalist is already taken by polygamists.
There's got to be a way to identify those people who are on that end of the spectrum, very, very conservative, and they're literalistic often,
right,
in their interpretation, and talk about a lack of complexity. It makes Newtonianism seem very complex in comparison. It's virtually a singularity, which is basically you subordinate your judgment to the judgment of the leaders of the church on every important issue. That is what makes a true-believing Mormon. That's when push comes to shove, you subordinate your judgment to the church leaders. Whereas the more nuanced you are, the more you're moving toward the left on the spectrum, to the point where you go over and then become a true believing atheist.
Well, so we're starting to slightly turn into, if not pumpkins, pumpkin stalks that are growing that Christine's students can observe. So we're going to just briefly sow. First off, as presaged earlier, right, can we handle the truth? And second, this other statement, is it true that, you know, these two very conflicting approaches, right? On the one hand, you can't handle the truth. On the other hand, the truth shall make you free. Is either of them, dare I say, true?
I want to hit the second one, because I think we've hit the first one in some detail. I have something that I think is important to say here.
Do you want us to all clap for you? You seem like you're so pleased with
that. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I kind of use self-congratulation.
I think this is, again, a problem that we, in the apostate community, see because... So a criticism that
liberal and academic Mormons will often throw at the apostate community is that, you know, you're very self-congratulatory in your new knowledge of, like, basic Mormon history that, of course, we have known for decades. And not only have we known for decades, but, like, we understand a lot better than you do. You get a lot of stuff wrong, and you're really, you know, maybe you're one step above the gospel doctrine manual that you knew before, but you're really only one step above.
You actually believe in the Spalding theory, and you're
right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Somebody actually believes in the Spalding theory. That's a great example. I'm of course more sympathetic as somebody who's gone through apostasy, because they didn't get this idea that the historical truths were moral propositions on their own. That was given to them, right? As we talked about all the way earlier. They were taught from a young age that these truth propositions are also moral propositions. And so knowing the truth is something that they need in order to make decisions about what they're going to do with their moral lives. And so it's not too surprising that people who aren't historians yet engage in amateur history because they feel like they have to because apparently they've been handed forces them to.
That makes sense. Christine, Greg, do you want to discuss or... Should we take a question? Yeah. All right, go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that one of the things you're talking about is two sides of the same coin. In Mormonism, and not just Mormonism, there's this extremism, this black and white that culturally plays off. And instead of creating a dialectic somewhere in the middle or finding new paradigms, it's either true or it's not true. Or we are right, and no, we're right, you're wrong, instead of finding. But to some extent, that's a cultural trait of us, unfortunately, that and it plays out. And so we become apostate or we leave. We're using some of the same extreme mechanisms that we did when we were kids.
So the comment was that faithful Mormon and apostate Mormon narratives are, in some sense, flip sides of each other. They still have this black and white mentality. Everything's either completely true or completely false. And a lot of apostates will take that with them instead of constructing some more complex or nuanced dialectic in the middle. Responding to that, I think that there's a lot of right in that, but I think that it misses a couple things. In my experience, apostates from Mormonism, particularly those who become atheists or agnostics, are actually quite good at expressing things in uncertain terms. I think it's very rare to find the apostate Mormon who thinks that for 100% probability the usual bundle of truth claims is false, and with 100% probability there is no God. I think they're actually pretty good at saying, look, I am deploying this probabilistic methodology, and when I turn the crank on that probabilistic methodology, I get that these truth claims have very, very low probability of being true. And since I need to make decisions, I'm going to act according to those probabilities. What I think apostates tend to be bad at, back here, and that's something that they learned from...
That was substantially more nicely wrapped up than most of us manage, but... Okay, thank you.
Okay. I guess I'm describing myself from a couple years ago. Really, that's it. Whereas I think the average believing Mormon does not even appreciate that uncertainty. They think that they are 100%, this is absolutely true, or there's no chance that I'm wrong. And so in one sense, that is a pretty good sort of acceptance of the complexity. And then, to beat the old horse, what the apostate is bad at realizing the probabilistic framework that he's using is just another framework, and there's nothing intrinsic about it. Or she. My apologies.
It. They.
So we've got a small amount, but definite amount of time. So let's hear some, do we have closing thoughts from folks? Christine.
Well, this may be opening two big can of worms, but I think we also have to think about to what degree decisions about affiliating and disaffiliating are aesthetic ones. That is, we find a bunch of people whose tastes are more like ours and want to belong with them rather than to Mormons. So anyway, that might be a set of questions to consider.
Sure, yeah. How much is an aesthetic choice? No, Mormons.
More than we'd like to admit.
More than we admit.
At least.
All right, let's get like maybe two or three questions, and then we'll start a conversation. Go ahead.
Well, Well, take a comment from an old lady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
been around a while. I first came to Sunstone in 86, so and I've been around here a long time, and I guess I'm one of the apostates you talk about. But that couplet is what inspired me to think that I could read anything I wanted to read. And when I was in high school, I read No Man Knows My History. I didn't know that, you know, and I thought that was a really good book. And it's, I didn't, you know, I've been thinking about these things. It makes sense to me. But anyway, now that I'm old and I've gone through all this, the way I look at it, that true-believing Mormons, you have a reality that isn't yours. It's the reality someone else has given you. That you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. When you develop your own reality, test it. It's painful, and come up with your own, the one that makes sense to you because of the life you've led, the experiences you've had. You just don't even worry about the things y'all are talking about.
Quite possibly, yeah. Do you want to? We have another hand behind you.
I'm just thinking about this discussion about methodological pluralism, and I'm wondering to what extent do you think believing Mormons can affirm the legitimacy of other methodologies, which, because I think certain methodologies are going to necessarily result in loss of belief, and so I think that's where you run into some trouble, is that there's a point, it seems to me, that Mormons are going to say, you're using the wrong methodology, and that's how it is. You need to change your methodology. You're getting the wrong results.
So I'm being told that I have to at least acknowledge one person in this room who is pretty good, who is a believing Mormon, who is pretty good at affirming other people's methodologies. But then again, he has also threatened me with hellfire on a couple of occasions, and so, you know, it gets a little complicated. But there, I think that's possible. I think that's part of the glory of the larger interactions that we're having with each other. In, you know, we sit and talk with each other, even maybe while we're at work sometimes, and like in ways that friends never have been able to. And so you get into more things, and you start to learn more things about each other, and so then the pluralism naturally grows in the conversation in a way that it didn't so much when communities were more homogenous.
I also want to say that there's an aesthetic component to whether people will accept different methodologies. I think if you use Mormon words, Mormon metaphors, like the one in Alma 32, you know, and I used to say, you can say anything if you wear a flowered dress with a lace collar. Right? I mean, there are ways to push people without making them feel threatened and pull back, and a lot of that is just aesthetics and style.
So I'm going to start wearing flower dresses with lace collars. I think there's absolutely something to that, which is that some versions of Mormonism strongly reject the legitimacy of any other methodology. And with people in that mindset, it is basically impossible to have a dialogue. At the same time, I've had fantastic conversations with a lot of believing Mormons who don't have that mindset, and I've had conversations with really obnoxious non-believers who absolutely have super closed-minded approaches. So it's not limited to Mormonism, but yes, there are versions of Mormon methodology that can be very, very closed.
And I think it is worth mentioning that it is the mainstream version of Mormonism that is inherently anti-pluralistic. I would say your average Orthodox Mormon cannot become pluralist without becoming something other than your average Orthodox Mormon.
Please.
Please rebut.
I was just going to say, I think that's partly true, but I also think that here in North America, people are Americans as well as Mormons, and so they do actually accept some degree of pluralism about some things, even though they would never admit it.
They aren't consciously pluralist.
Right.
Okay,
right.
That's fine. Yeah, yeah. I think that's
right. Such
yeah.
Yeah, well, that's true. I have never lived here, so, yeah.
And semantics gets in the way of that, too, because of this in-group kind of wording that we have. It sounds like everyone admits that we're all more
pluralistic methodologically and otherwise than you admit. And so I just submit that using a phrase like TBM is probably too broad a brush and discourages people from recognizing the variety within mainstream belief.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I do agree with that.
I think we have time for two more comments, so let's go with Sarah and with...
I'll be brief because I've already talked, but
I just wanted to say that as a proselytizing religion, I think that Mormonism absolutely privileges action, you know, and is not as open to the mullers and, you know, I don't know. That there's, you know, Matt said something earlier about the more complex something is, the least likely we are to take action. Like the higher the complication grows, the more our stasis is. You know, that Hamlet problem. I don't think Mormons really like, mulling, pondering.
That's why Mormons are good businessmen.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, but I mean, that's a real privilege, right? You know, that, like, action is what looks like faith, but there's obviously a way of being very faithful or very considerate that just doesn't, from the outside, it does not look like action to one.
Way back behind Paul.
I don't really need a microphone that side. I just wanted to say a comment rather than a question. For me, the first crack in my faith about 20 years ago was the issue when you brought up, I believe it was the second slide, about ask and if God, if it's true, and then we confirm to your heart, and this concept of personal revelation about the truth. And when I was a true believing Mormon and thought the church is true, Joseph Smith was a true prophet, the Book of Mormon is true, and then I would read news stories about a couple of recent examples. The people in San Diego that killed themselves because they believed that a spaceship was coming down to take them away. Another one recently, the preacher who said the end of the world is coming, so people sold all of their belongings to put up signs, all those sorts of stories, and working with the polygamists all the time because they had a business, so they were independent contractors in sewing, realizing that they firmly believed that they had the truth. I finally realized, wow, I thought I had the truth and prayed and had it verified, but they all clearly, other people believe they have the truth, or they wouldn't do such crazy things. So anyway, it was like a really big, the first crack in my faith about 20 years ago to realize that my concept of believing the truth wasn't valid.
Can I go to the mic for a second? I think that's a great sort of capstone to what, you know, truth, as I think our panelists have pointed out, is a deeply problematic concept, and in fact is much more contested than we like to give it credit for, and may have these deep fissures. And at the same time, truth matters, and it matters because it motivates people to do things in certain ways. And so maybe it's important that we have these discussions. And I don't know, what else do we want to say to...
I feel good.
All right. So thank you for coming to our panel. And we hope to see you at some other ones. And if you have any questions, we'll discuss them.
Thank you.